Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. Will you please welcome to West Coast Live actor and autobiographer, you know him as Sulu from Star Trek, Mr. George Takei. Was it conventional transport that got you here today?
No, I wouldn't call a limousine a conventional transport, but it was terrestrial.
To the Stars is the name of your autobiography, Star Trek's Mr. Sulu, a picture of you in uniform in the front and in a dashing maroon turtleneck on the back.
What? I'm glad I didn't wear that turtleneck today.
It's out of the cleaners or
something? As a matter of fact, it is in the washing machine. I left it there. Rotting.
What's in your closet? Do you have any old Star Trek uniforms in your closet?
Oh, you're asking about an actor's closet, are you? Oh, there are more than clothes in actors' closets. And that's why they're in closets, with the door closed.
Well, I wonder what that means.
That's precisely the impression I wanted to leave you with.
I was very interested to read this account of your life because so often, I mean, you're known as in public for a particular role, but your first major acting role was in one of the live CBS TV shows, Playhouse 90. You were studying acting at UCLA for a time. You were studying acting or studying architecture at UC Berkeley. But even before that, in your youth, you had one of those Japanese-American experiences that really is very frightening and terrifying to remember, that you were interned in the camps as a Japanese-American in your youth. How old were you during that time?
I was 4 years old, and quite to the contrary, it wasn't for me a frightening or terrifying experience. I really didn't understand. I was much too young to understand what that was all about. I do remember the barbed wire fence that surrounded where we lived, the black tar paper barracks that we lived in the guard towers with the armed guards looking down at us. But, you know, to a child, they're just things that are there, part of the landscape. The barbed wire fences were no more intimidating than a chain link fence around a playground here. And my real memories are fun memories, you know, for a kid tromping through the swamps of Arkansas or playing in the snow are great. I mean, particularly for a Southern Californian kid to discover snow overnight, you know, that this landscape that you thought you knew is suddenly blanketed in white and the black tar paper barracks. It was a magical experience. And I wanted to keep the purity of that child's remembrances, but of course, that's not the whole picture. And writing about that, I knew I had to paint the larger canvas. And so I did considerable research. And I must confess, for me too, despite the fact that I grew up learning about the camp experience in bits and pieces, the research that I did was very illuminating, and writing about it was a wrenching experience for me.
Your parents had their dry cleaning business on Wilshire Boulevard confiscated. Your father had to sell his car for $5 at the time, and suddenly you were hustled off on a train, but your parents protected you as much as they could from that time.
They did. I recall my father telling us, my brother and my sister and I, that we were going for a long vacation in the country, and that's what it was for us. It wasn't until we were getting a little bit older that we knew that it wasn't quite what a vacation is supposed to mean.
Your mother at one point wanted to give up her American citizenship. There was a loyalty oath that was passed out, and there was kind of a catch-22 question that was in it. Many people in the camps chose to forswear anything to do with the Emperor of Japan and to pledge their allegiance to the United States. Your parents both chose no to those questions, and you later questioned them about it. You called your father on it in some way.
Well, that loyalty questionnaire was an amazing part. I didn't know about that really until I began the research, and it was to me a horrific discovery. here were Japanese Americans, American citizens that of Japanese ancestry that were already stripped of property, stripped of their dignity, and herded into these barbed wire encampments, and then to be subjected to this incredible cruelty of a loyalty questionnaire. It was a series of questions, about 33 questions. But the key two questions were questions 27 and 28. 27 asked, if you are willing to bear arms to defend the United States of America, here are armed men, soldiers keeping you within this confined, barbed wire confined area, and they're asking now if you'll bear arms to go out and fight for this country. Question 28 asked, one sentence with two ideas. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan, period? If you said yes, I will swear, if you answered yes, intending to swear loyalty to the United States, you were also admitting that there was a pre-existing loyalty to the Emperor to forswear. If you answered no, saying no, I do not have a pre-existing loyalty to the Emperor to forswear, then you were also answering no to loyalty to the United States of America. It was seen as a trap question, and those two questions through all 10 camps scattered throughout the Southwest and the South of America into turmoil. For my parents, it was a very difficult, in fact, harrowing experience to try to respond to that, because my mother was born here in the United States, in Sacramento, actually Florin, today a suburb of Sacramento. My father was brought here as a child by my paternal grandfather. My grandfather was a widower, and he came with his two boys, my father and his older brother. So my father was born in Japan, but brought here as a child and educated here in America. But the laws of the United States did not allow Asians to become naturalized citizens. So here they were asking him to bear arms for a country that stripped him of property, wouldn't recognize him as a citizen, indeed considered him an enemy, and had him incarcerated, and now asking him to bear arms. Obviously, it was a no answer. Number 28 asked him to swear loyalty to a country that wouldn't allow him to become a citizen to begin with, and then forswear. My father didn't particularly have any loyalty to the Emperor of Japan. He grew up here in this country. And yet, you know, Japan was the only country that he could consider to be a country receptive to him as a citizen. The United States wouldn't accept him. So that question was essentially asking him to be a man with no country. He had to answer no to that too. My mother essentially was being asked to choose between the country of her birth and her husband, her family, or the United States, one or the other. My mother obviously knew which way she was going to answer. She answered no to both questions. And because they responded no to those two key questions, they were labeled disloyals. And we had to be moved to another camp in Northern California near the Oregon border, Tule Lake. And so we were again moved from the camp in Arkansas to the camp in Northern California, Tule Lake. Tule Lake was a camp that was much, much more politicized than any of the other camps because of the very nature of the camp and the reasons why they were put in that
high. You were the so-called disloyalists who were there.
Disloyals. But within that category of disloyals, there was a whole range of political beliefs from people like my parents who responded no to the loyalty questionnaire in a dignity-sustaining outrage, to the far extreme where Japanese Americans who felt so betrayed by this country that they went to the other extreme. All right, if they're going to treat us like enemies, by gum, we're going to give them enemies to be reckoned with. And the leader of that, ironically, was a veteran of the First World War, Joe Kurihara. And one of his famous quotes in the Japanese-American community is, he was so angered. You know, this was a country that he fought for in the First World War. He was a citizen of this country. He considered himself a patriot. And now this is the way this country would treat him. He said, if I'm going to be a Jap 100%. And he became the leader of what was called the radical element. These people were, and I remember, even as a child, by that time I was 6, 7, and 8, waking up in the morning to the chant of their working out, calisthenics. They would jog in unison around the camp, and I'd hear their washoy, washoy, washoy as they jogged around the camp, blocks.
What does washoy mean?
It's just like hup to, hup to, hup to. Except it's in the Japanese military, you know, kind of. They consider themselves Japanese loyalists now, and they had.
The headbands. Although some members of the camp chose to join, like the 442nd.
Well, not from Tule Lake.
Not from Tule Lake.
The ones that many of those that answered yes, yes, volunteered. The irony of having your parents, brothers and sisters, your children behind barbed wire, and wearing the uniform of the guards that were keeping them there and fighting for this country in Europe. It was a surreal time, and you know, I'm glad that I was young as I was then, because I don't know how I would have reacted to all that bizarre expressions of, or definition of what loyalty meant. Mm-hmm. Did loyalty mean giving up, you know, who you were, your own dignity, your sense of who you are, and going and fighting for this amorphous thing that really was the prison keepers of your family? My parents were in this other camp that was for disloyals, but again, there was it was a turbulent camp with political infighting.
From your point of view also, I mean, it was a time where you, for instance, were able to watch movies and become interested in
That's
movies.
Right. I was, because of my age, I was saved all that. This is all things that I discovered in my research for my autobiography. But for me, it was growing up again. And in Tule Lake, I remember movies that they showed in mess halls. And one of the more vivid memories I have, they showed American movies, but they also showed Japanese movies. But for some odd reason, they'd lost the soundtrack. So they had a narrator who knew the plot, who knew the dialogue, who sat at the bottom of the screen, and he had various sound devices, coconut shells for hoofbeats and things like that. And he provided the dialogue and the sound effect. And it was one man, usually, who did all the voices, from the old cackly crone to the elegant princess to the gruff samurai to the peasant groveling. You know, he did all the voices, and it was, to me, absolutely fascinating, you know.
What was that role called?
They were called Benshi.
And wasn't your first acting role or voice role almost doing identical things?
Interestingly enough, the first time I got paid to do any acting was when I dubbed in the English dialogue to a Japanese science fiction film called Rodan.
And so you found yourself doing several voices.
I was reminded of the Benshis that I heard when I was in Camp Tule Lake. Yes.
Well, I know I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about something about Star Trek, but first, something about your father, who was an advisor to you, wanted you to go through college and so forth. When you first started earning a paycheck, you wanted to go out and buy an MG convertible. But what did he do? He had you invest in mortgages for cemetery plots?
Yes, he thought, I was fairly lucky landing one role after another at that time, and I thought this is the way it was going to be. And I said, you know, Daddy, I want to get to the car that I was dreaming about, an MG Roadster. It'd be great to go to UCLA in one of those. And my father said, yes, it would be, but that's not an investment. A car is a rolling depreciation.
So do you still hold mortgages on cemetery plots?
Well, he was in real estate at the time, so he took my money. I protested. I mean, it was painful, but he said, no, it's feast or famine in your business, and you're enjoying the feast now. But to keep the famine from being that famine, let's put it into a genuine investment. And he put it into small real estate investments. They turned out to be cemetery plots. Yeah. The irony of, you know, cemetery plots as insurance for my career livelihood.
In case you ever happen to die on stage or something, I guess. So,
oh, we die many deaths. I'm glad I had many cemetery plots then.
So the you have led in many ways a kind of a typical American life. I mean, adversity, I mean, being raised in the internment camps as a Japanese American. Well, you know, in the sense that you then end up putting your handprint in the cement outside the Chinese Grauman Theater, which in fact isn't Chinese anyway, but and acquiring this fame and this sort of worldwide celebrity as this character of the future talking about world harmony and peace and trying to enforce it, you know, as ultimate successors to the UN ideal.
And you consider that a typical American life?
You know, Horatio Alger in its way, but distinct in its own way. I mean, you've made it your own.
I mean,
to captain of the Excelsior, for crying
exactly.
out.
Exactly. In many ways, it is an American life. You know, this kind of life could not happen, I don't think, anywhere else. Certainly, the internment kind of experience could not have happened anywhere, and hopefully it never happens in America again. But to come from that kind of experience and to have the kind of father who believed incredibly, as incredible as it may sound, in the basic fundamental ideals of the American system. He said, the ideals are great. They're noble, they're glowing, but it's dependent on people, and the people are fallible. And unless the good people are in there keeping that ideal true, then it's subject to the fallibility of the people. And so it's important that we go in there and participate in the so-called participatory democracy. That really took with my brother and my sister and myself, and we were both student body presidents in junior high school, and I was senior board president in high school. So he volunteered us to the Adlai Stevenson campaign before I could even vote. So, this system is something that my father believed in. And in 1954, when they passed the law making Asians eligible for naturalized citizenship, my father became an American citizen. And he voted for the first time for Adlai Stevenson. And so when I voted for the first time, when I came of age, it was for Adlai Stevenson that I voted for as well, and I campaigned for him. And my track record for supporting presidential candidates, I guess, was more or less consistent with...
because your cemetery plots came in handy?
Well, I was a delegate to the Democratic National Convention in 1972, and we nominated none other than George McGovern, right. Consistent with Adlai Stevenson. And then where it broke was when I was an alternate to the 1976 convention, and we nominated Jimmy Carter. And there we had a winner, and he's turning into a very distinguished post-presidential elder statesman now, it seems. So in that respect, yeah, it's an American story.
In many ways, your career as an Asian American actor has been a diplomatic story as well. I mean, you know, part of the inside history of Star Trek has been like holding out for what you have achieved in terms of compensation to be at a par with the other actors and so forth, holding your own, becoming promoted to a captain. I know that a lot of that has been your own particular drive and desire to do that. What's ahead in your Star Trek life?
Well, you know, I think the ideal of Star Trek was a wonderful thing. When I sat down to write my autobiography, I saw it as something that makes a statement for the whole of my life, because Star Trek was really a metaphor for what we need to do to face the challenges of a pluralistic society. And what Star Trek said was that we need to recognize that our strength is in our pluralism, to tap the best of that person with that history, that person with that experience or background, this person with this capability, and to work together as a unit, as a team, with leadership to face that common challenge that we have.
Whether or not you actually like the captain?
Well, we're actors playing, bringing flesh and blood to this.
I was taking the ideal back into the fallible world of human beings.
Exactly, and you know, that is part of the pluralism too, and that was one of the points I tried to make, that we have people with obvious talents, with hidden fallibilities, and we have, for example, in The Next Generation, a character that's blind, Geordi LaForge, a black blind character. The blindness is obviously a handicap, and yet he has hidden strengths. So, you know, we all have our pluses and minuses. That's part of the pluralism. And to recognize that as part of the whole, and to tap the strengths, and the actor that played the captain with his strengths as well as his fallibility, we are still a part of that team. And we need to recognize that, and to learn to tolerate the fallibilities, and to recognize a strength, and still be able to work together and develop a modus vivendi.
Well, thank you for being an illustration of that in your life. I mean, your story certainly shows that. It's called To the Stars, the autobiography of George Takei, Star Trek's Mr. Sulu. Thank you very much for being on West Coast Live.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being with you.
Thank you very much. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.